1, 2. Der, vet du. Good morning, and welcome to lectures in IMT 4116, Reverse Engineering and Malware Analysis. Collaborate should be up, stream is going. Please interrupt with questions if you have any. Couple of things before we start. In Blackboard, you will find information about the exam. The exam dates are out, so I put that information there. Also some information about the assignments, with suggested dates. We'll get more, try to have a more concrete information next Monday when I hand out the assignments. I also put out very short tutorial that Sergey, the teaching assistant, made for how to use IDA Pro. Please read chapter 5 and look at that so you familiarize yourself with it. You need IDA Pro for the lab today. The chapter that we're covering today is chapter 6 in the book, Recognizing C Code Constructs in Assembly. Before I start, just also mention that next Monday is our first workshop and guest lecture. Nursert is coming up here. They have promised me to talk you through a case. And after they have done that, we will hand out a malware sample. And writing a malware analysis report on that sample based on what you have learned up until now will be the assignment, the first assignment. More details next week. But really excited about the guest lecture next Monday. We have 2 hours of lectures and 2 hours of labs. I have told the lecturer that he can go over 2 hours with the presentation if he feels that he has enough or a lot he wants to share with you. So will be the transition between the lecture and the lab might be not so sharp next week. I will make sure to stream and record until the lecture is over, whenever that will be. So people online won't miss any of the lecture part. All right. Chapter 6, Recognizing C Code Constructs in Assembly. I had a crash course in x86 in assembly last week. Now we're going to take it one step further and see how the high-level language C, what it looks like in when we break it down in assembly. When you're reverse engineering or doing analysis of malware, don't read every instruction. That's too tedious. The code is too long. You can't start from the top and just go through everything. What you need to do is get the high level picture. Just understand what a certain collection of assembly code, what the function is. And that's what we're going to do today. Look at different C C contracts and like loops and conditional statements, and see what it looks like. There will be differences here between compilers. So two different compilers will give different results. Also, different compiler settings. So two compilations with the same compiler but different settings might give different results. This can be choices that the compiler makes. It can be optimization settings. I'll show a couple of examples of it. But just be aware that the examples that I show might not be the same for all compilers. And then I'm probably going to repeat it many times. Do not get stuck trying to understand every single instruction. You need to understand the overall functionality. Your goal is to see the big picture. What is this malware doing? And if you try to understand every single instruction, you will get lost and never finish the analysis. Couple of things about first about variables. We have to differentiate between global and local variables. If you have programmed a lot, you know this. Global variables accessible for any function in the program, but local variables only accessible for the function where they're defined. And there are two examples here. In the first one, the variables are defined outside the main program, so they're global. In this, the one on the right, they're defined inside, so they're local. Not a big difference when you just see the program here, but there is a lot of difference in assembly. And I'll go through both examples. Everything here, by the way, is from the book. So if you look at the global variables first, you'll see that they use the term D word and then something that looks like an address. And that is how the global variable X is represented. It's stored at the memory location 40CF60, and this is the way that variable is represented. So if you see the notation D word and then something that looks like an address, then that's a global variable stored somewhere in memory, and that location somewhere is usually is the number behind D word. So the first line there is the global variable X, and then you have the variable Y, then is stored at a different location. So what this means is that you take the variable X from the memory location here, move it into EAX, then use the add instruction that takes the variable Y, adds it to EAX, and the results ends up in EAX. And then we move the result, which is now in EAX, back into the memory location of 40CF60, which was X. So you move the result back in X. And that's what we wanted to do. If we go back here, X plus Y, move the result back in X. Then we want to print the result. Then you need to call a function, call printf, and if you remember from last time, then you need to push the arguments you use on the stack. So first you move the result, so this is the X variable, global variable, into ECX, then you push ECX, put the value on top of the stack. You also put this is the string onto print, onto the stack, and then you call the function printf that takes these two arguments and produces and prints the result. So that was what it looks like when you have X and Y as global variables. Please interrupt if this does not make sense or if I'm going too fast. Okay, so far? Too slow? No? If it's too basic, let me know that too. Okay, what does it look like if we have a local variable, like the second example? Well, then you see that the variables themselves are represented in a different way. If you look here, x is then not located in a memory location, but it's located on the stack. And there's an offset of 4 bytes from EBP. That's what this means, EBP minus 4. So it's a DWARD pointer and then an address in a bytes. And it points to the stack, the base pointer, minus 4. So 4 bytes from the top of the stack. That's where we have the local variable x. And then the next line should make sense, because then it's the EBP minus 8. So 4 bytes, 32 bits further down on the stack. That's where we put y. Just note that I copied this from the PDF version of the book, and they have a typo. In the book, it should be x equals 1 and y equals 2. So the notation here, EBP minus 4 and EBP minus 8, stack-based local variable. So if you see variables on this format, it's a local variable and you find it on the stack. If you see the D word and then an address, then it's a global variable found in memory. Just notice that IDAPRO prints this or interprets this a little bit different. So EBP minus 4, so 4 bytes down on the stack, is written as EBP plus var 4. So they just say that, okay, we start with the base pointer of the stack and we go 4 bytes away. But that's the same notation, means the same as this. So EBP minus 8 will be written as EBP plus var 8. So if you see EBP plus var and then a number, it's IDAPRO's way of telling you this is a local variable put on a stack. The number is the offset from EBP. If you are local IDAPRO already, or if you're about to, then you've learned that you can rename variable functions names and so forth in IDAPRO. That is smart to do. So when you discover that EBP plus var4 in IDA is the variable X, then change that name and label it X. And then it will change that for all the local variables with that name in IDAPRO, and it's much easier to read. Okay, so when we know that these are two local variables, the rest is the same. You take then the variable from the stack, which is x, into EX. You add the next value on the stack, which is y, add it to x, and put the result in EX. Move the results back in the local variable x on the stack. Then we're done with the calculation. Then we take the x value from the stack, move into ECX, push it onto the stack, push the string total equals onto the stack, and calls the print function. Okay? Everything okay online? Hold on, Emil. Is that somebody here? He's online. Nice to have you with us, Emil. Okay, so that was variables. Remember this when we go through other examples. Let's look at arithmetic operations. Here's the example we're going to go through. 2 integers. We're going to look at how we add a number to one integer, how we subtract 2 integers, how we decrement by 1, how we increment by 1, and then the modulo 3 in this case operation, where we divide and the result is the remainder after division. So the two first variables, now we don't see um, These are defined together with the rest here, so we interpret as local variables. So then we use two positions on the stack, put the value of 0 and 1 into this. So this first one would be A, and the one variable displaced 8 bytes from the stack pointer will be B. So what does A equals A plus 11 look like? Well, then we take the value A, which is stored on the stack at this position, put it into EAX with a move instruction. Then we add 0B in hex. B in hex is 11. So we add that to EAX, put the result back in EAX, and then we have done this. And then we write the result back in the variable A on the stack. Next one, A equals A minus B. Take the A value, put it into ECX, and then we take the B value found further down the stack, subtract it from ECX, and write the result back in ECX. Take the result and put back in 4, which is the A variable. You guys with me? Good. Moving on. What does decrement by 1 look like? Again, first one operates on the A variable that we find on the stack. Move it into EDX. Then they have used the subtract 1 from EDX and write the result back into the A variable. Notice that instead of subtract, why not use decrement? That's another assembly code that you could have used. That is the compiler's choice. It could be optimization, it could be settings, whatever they decided to do. So this is the first example where you could have done this by using a different opcode to implement this. The increment is similar. Just move the B variable into EX, then you add 1 and write the results back to the stack. And finally, the modulo operation is supposed to be done on the A variable and result written into B. So then we fetch the A variable first, put it into EAX. Then there's instruction here so that if you don't know what this means, then you have to look it up. I had to do that. CDQ converts a double word to quad word. That means that it's, instead of writing the value only in EAX, it uses EDX and EAX combined in order to facilitate larger numbers if we need that. And that's necessary when we do divide, because the next operation is to take the argument here, modulo 3. So we take 3 into ECX, and then the division operation here. There are lots of ways of doing division. If you want the finer detail on the difference between IDIV and other divisions, then you use the manual. But this means that you take, what this instruction does is that it takes the extended number here. So it takes EDX and EAX and divides it by the value in ECX. And then the result of that division is written into EAX, and the remainder is put into EDX. And when we do a modulo operation, we're concerned with what's left over. So that's why our result is then found in EDX, and that's what we put into. We want it into B, so we put it into the local variable B on the stack, displaced by 8 bytes. Somebody's nodding at least. You're not falling asleep, but you understand this? Good. Online, too basic, or okay. Too late for me to change it now, but I can change it for next time if you give me feedback. All right, and it gets worse. So, if statements. If statements are there to alter the program execution so that we can actually have some different paths depending on decisions made in the program. And your goal here is to learn how to recognize different if statements in assembly. An if statement in assembly, you have to have a conditional jump. And if you remember conditional jumps, there's a comparison, something in a line before that alters a flag, and then there's the jump and two letters that could be greater than or equal to, not zero, and so forth, about 20 or 30 different ones. There has to be a conditional jump. Just make, but don't think that once you see a conditional jump, you see an if statement. That's not true. So it doesn't go the other way. But if you're looking for this, you have to find a conditional jump. So let's look at a simple example. Two integers, and if x equals 1, we print that they're equal, else we print that they're not equal. Simple enough. What does it look like in assembly? Like this. Again, global or local variables, local, because we refer them to the stack. So first we move x into the var 8 and y into the var 4. Then we get the x value. We compare the y to the x that we put in here. So this is the compare. This is the operation that affects the flags. Then we have the conditional jump. Jump if not zero, and if it's not zero, we jump to this address, 4102B, that will be here. But if it is zero, then we continue, and then we push a string, x equal y, because if it's if we go past here, then we have x equals y, and then we call the print function. And this add button here should tell you something. That's the stack cleanup. That means that this function did not clean up. It was the caller that cleaned up. This is the way you can see the caller conventions. And then there's a jump, the unconditional jump. So this one will jump to 38, and that's outside. That's probably down here. That just means that it jumps over the else part if it has performed this, because you don't want it to do both. And then if we jump down here, then you get push x is not equal to y, and you print that result. So first a decision for two paths, and an unconditional jump over the else path is what you need to look for. Okay, and then we'll look at what does this look like in IDAPRO. IDAPRO can show you the assembly code like this, but it also has a graphical view, which is really helpful. And then it looks like this, and you can just by looking at this and not looking at the code at all, you can see that there's a condition involved here. You have something happens up here, and that just by looking at the colors of the paths in IDA, then red means that the condition was false, green means it's true. So just something happens, there's a comparison, conditional jump. If it was false, you end up here, if it was true, you end up here, and then this blue one means that that's a normal execution path, so paths end up down here no matter what. So without going into the detail, you can see that this is, here's a conditional jump. And if you look at the details inside the box, we'll find the comparison here. Here's the compare. Then is the conditional jump, jump not zero. And here is the print x equals y. And here's print x is not equal to y. And both end up in 41038 that we saw last time too. And then there's something extra here that I didn't show on the previous one. But that's the little bit cleaning up. And also here, you should be able to see that there is no stack cleanup here, but it returns from some function called this, and it returns without cleaning up the stack. So that should tell you something about the calling convention. That's left up for the caller. Okay. More complicated nested if statements. We have x, y, and z. We want to find out if z equals zero, or if and if these two are equal. So first, if x equals y, we go in here, and then we check if z is equal zero. And if it's not, if it is, then we print z equals zero and x equals y. If not, z is non-zero and x equals y. Then we have the other else condition, which is x is not equal to y, and then we check on z on both, so we get z equals 0, and x is not equal to y, and z non-zero and x not equal to y. Simple enough in C. This is what it looks like in assembly. And now I can't reach up the point, but the three first lines is just setting the variables x, y, and z. Local variables found 4, 8, and 12 bytes displays from the EBP. Then the first test here is done on variable 8 and 4. And 8 and 4 means x and y. So the first thing is to compare, is x equal to y? And then the conditional jump. And if the answer is no, x is not equal to y, then it jumps to this location, 401047, which is down here. Just a short comment. If you see the memory layout here, you see that they make it easier for us to locate location where it's jumped to, because this address is written twice. But this is just a comment line. This is what's actually on that address. It just makes it easier to read. So if x is not equal to y, then you jump here. And if not, you continue. The next test is to see, is z equal 0? And then you have you're setting the flag accordingly. And jump if not 0, so you jump if no. And then you jump to 401038. Which is right here. Otherwise, you have made a decision and you push z is 0 and x equals y. You know that if you reach this, you print it, you clean up the stack. So this is called the epilogue of the function call. And then you have an unconditional jump, because now you're done printing, so you want to jump over everything else. So you jump to 401045. Which is here, just another unconditional jump to 401069. That is outside the program, and you're done with everything here. And similarly, if you have to go to the else part, first you go here, z was not zero, then you print z is not zero, x equal y, and then you repeat everything down here for x equal y. If this didn't make sense right away, then spend 5 minutes studying it. If it really worth it to go through every line and understand every single jump in a relative simple example like this. Because this is what you need. It's much easier now when we have, if we have it up here, you have my comments, you have the book. When you find a assembly code like this in a random sample, it's not that easy. Because then you have 10,000 things in your head and you wonder, what am I looking at? So that was if statements and nested if statements. Then there is something called loops. Simple enough in C. We initialize variable I, and then we have a for I equals 0 to I less than 100, increment by 1, and then print I equals whatever it is. A simple program that counts up to 100 and prints the result. What's important to remember when you're looking for loops is that they have four components. They have one initialization phase up here. Then they compare something. The comparison will be, is I still in this range? And then they execute something, and that in this case, this is the print part. And then they repeat and increment or decrement. In this case, increment and do this again. And finding loops is about finding these four sections. So, again, straight into assembly. Local variable displaced by 4 bytes from EBP. Put 0 in there. That's the initialization, I equals 0. Then for some reason they jump right away, unconditional jump to 401.016. So they jump down here. If you see what they jump over is the section where you increment by 1. So you take I into EAX, you add 1 to EAX, and you write EAX back to the stack. So this is increment I by 1. But they jump over that first and go straight here. And then they do the comparison. Compare 64 hex. If you're not familiar with hex, then convert this to Tital-Systema. Decimal, thanks. Early, too little coffee. In IDA, that's simple. You right-click and there are options. So you compare 100 to the variable I. And if the comparison, and then you jump if it's greater or equal. And if it's greater or equal, you jump to 4102F, which is outside this program. So that means that I is greater than 100 and you're done with your loop. If you're not done with your loop, then you take I into ECX. You push ECX on the stack. You push your string, I equals a number, onto the stack, and you call the print function. So this is the preparation of the stack for calling a function. And then there's an add 8 bytes to ESP, and that's the epilogue. You remove 2 values because you put 2 values onto the stack before you call the print function. Then you remove two functions, 2 times 4 bytes, 2 32-bit instructions. And then you jump, and this time you jump up here to where you increment I, and then you continue down. Easy when I say it. The trick is to recognize this when you see a code that nobody told you what to look for. So again, make sure you're comfortable with this. And here again, IDA helps. This is a graphical presentation of what I just went through in assembly. And it's a more logic flow. And again, without looking at the code, you can understand something. I didn't put the colors in there, but false will be red, and the green would be the true would be green. So here you can recognize the four steps. There's an initialization, there's a comparison, there's something you execute, and there's an increment. And it's very nice to see that if you get a blue arrow that goes back up, then look for these four parts and see if you're dealing with a loop. And then there's an end statement. You end up down here when you're done. So again, find initialization, comparison, execution, increment, and the blue arrow back up. You're most likely looking at a loop. And then you can dig into the details and see what makes the loop go here or there, or what is it doing. So this is the high level that you need to be at. You need to be able to look at either Pro or assembly if you're more comfortable. Some people are probably more might be more comfortable here than here. Up to you. You need to recognize this and see, hey, there's a loop. And then the question, why do we have a loop? What is the loop doing? Okay, there is something's going on here. And in this case, this loop calls a function. Well, we know that in this simple example, a function is print. And again, this here we have a written print, but you could change that to print once you found out that that's what it's doing. Analyzing malware, this function can be doing whatever. And then you follow this function and you analyze what it's doing. And once you establish what it's doing or have an idea, then you change the name sub 401.035 to whatever you think the function is doing. That way the readability of your code increases. But for now, we're trying to recognize these high-level constructs. Okay, different, there's while loops. You go in a loop until a condition is met. Very popular if you're needing to receive a package or a command. Can be useful for malware. So you have two variables, a status and a result. You have a while loop here that goes around as long as state equals zero. You call a function that looks for a result. Can be whatever. And then you check that result in a different function, and then you set the status according to the return value from that function. And if that status is satisfactory, then you jump out of the loop. If not, then you continue until you get the result that gives you the status you want. Again, loop until you receive the correct package, or you to receive the command that tells the malware to do something else, then wait. So this is important to identify. Okay, so back to assembly. Again, now we're getting familiar with these, how we set the initial variables. Again, local variables. Status equals null, result equals null. Then we start. And you compare EBP var 4. So you compare the status to the value 0. That's the condition up here. And if it's not 0, you jump out of this loop. So set the flags here, and if it's not 0, then status is not equal to 0, and you jump out, and you're done. Otherwise, you go into the loop here, and you call a function called perform action, what it can be whatever. Then you take the result. Remember that most function, the convention here is that a lot of function return the result in the EIX register. So when you see somebody calling a function and immediately using EIX, they're using the result, the return value from the function. Putting that in a local variable on the stack, and this local variable is this one. So that's the result. And then there's another prologue here, because now you take the, okay, you took the results in there, then you take the local variable result, you move it into EAX in order to push it on the stack, and then you call the function check result. Let me just comment on this. It, when you read this, it makes, it might look like a waste of time when you have, you first you move the value into EAX and then you take it, I'm sorry, EAX in there, and then you move it back into EAX. That seems like a waste of instructions, because isn't it already in EAX? Again, that's what the compiler chooses to do. An optimization will try to take care of things like this, or there might be other reasons that I can't think of right now that says that it has to be like this. But if you see things like this, assembly code is not it's a little bit basic, so you need to make many very simple steps. But anyway, is there a question? No. Anyway, so at a prologue, you push the variables needed for the function onto the stack, you call the function, and then after you call that, you see there's an add ESP4, and that is cleaning up the stack. You pushed one variable on, you take one off. Then you use the result from the function EAX. You move it into variable 4, which is the status. And you jump back up to the beginning here. And then you do the compare. And remember that what you're comparing is the status to 0, and you just updated the status. So now you have a new situation. Clear? Good? We'll start there after the break. I see there's two minutes left, but we'll take a 50-minute break and start on function calls 4:15. Okay. Couple of administrative points before we continue. To your folks online, I see that we had a chat in the break here, and what I realize is that if you're active on a chat, I don't have time to answer everything. It's just scroll down too fast for me here. So if I don't answer things on the chat, then repeat the question or send an email, and I'll try to pay attention. Also, I see that the chat went over to Norwegian, and that's fine. I think it looks like everybody is Norwegian online, so then no worries. If we end up in a different situation, at least I can try to answer in English. There's been a lot of questions online and in the classroom about exams. There are challenges. When I designed this course, I thought that the home exam giving you more time to dig into a code was the better choice from a learning perspective. So that's why I suggested it. I see that it can cause conflicts when you have study time for other exams and home exam at the same time. I have taken this up with the office that plans the exams. Unfortunately, it is really difficult to find a quiet, empty 3-day period during the exams. and I need the exam to be early because I need to correct or grade your exam before you have your oral exam. But please, I'm aware of this, and we'll try as best as we can to make the best out of it. And if I find out that this is just causing too many problems for students, then I'll I guess it won't help you, but it will help the next students. Then we'll find a different way of having the exam that is not as optimal, but better for the whole exam period as a whole. But please send me questions on email on that because somebody asked if it was enough to let me know in the chat, and the answer is no, because the chat is gone when I log out today and then I forget. So emails, please. All right, let's continue. Recognizing C constructs in assembly. We started off pretty simple. It only gets worse, unfortunately. Well, I'll try to guide you through it. Next is function calls. We already seen it, but what we're going to do now is just look at really simple function call in C. And what does it look like when we use different call conventions? If you remember, I talked about C decal. then the parameters are pushed from right to left, and the caller cleans up. And that's what we see here. So what I mean by right to left is that when you have A, B, C, then you start to the right with the C variable first. And that's what we see here. We push C on the stack, then B, then A. Then we call the function, we provided all the parameters. Then in this convention, then the caller cleans up. So three variables, three 32-bit or three 4-byte parameters means we have to adjust the stack pointer by 3 times 4 bytes, so 12 bytes when we clean up. And then the return value is found in EAX, that's also in the call convention. So we take that value, we move it into the variable RET that we want, or we want it. couple of other differences. Here we have a function that takes in two integers A and B and returns the sum. And then we have a program here that sets these two variables and prints the sum. The assembly code for the adder function is seen here. That's basically taking the argument from the stack, so local variables, into EAX, and then add the next value. And then we pop the return address and or the base pointer in, and then return. So very simple. What we're going to do now is look at the function call and two different calling conventions. And the title here is push versus move. Push being putting values on the stack, and move being the move instruction, move between memory location and registers. And both are valid. Visual Studio is the example we're going to use for push, and GCC version uses move. So setting the two local variables, base point plus 4, that's where we set 1, and then plus 8 we set 2. We fetch the variable from position 8 there, put it into EAX, push this onto the stack, and then we move the other variable into ECX, and we push ECX on the stack. So then we have two values on the stack, and we call the add function, the adder function. We clean up the stack pointer, and the result is found in EAX. Remember the calling convention, the result is in EAX. So we take EAX and push it on the stack. We push the string that we want on the stack, and then we call a print function. We'll print the text and the value. I think that's the convention that we've looked at so far. We use the stack and we push the variables onto the stack. Okay, the other version. Same thing here. Store the two values on the stack. Then we get the one variable, but then we see that we do something different here. Instead of pushing, so here we took the value 2 into EAX, and instead of pushing EAX on the stack, we move EAX to, and here is not the base point, so it's not the local variable, but it's a stack pointer plus 4. So we're moving it directly onto the stack with an offset. It's doing the same as the push, it's just that we don't use the push instruction. And then we get the second value, put it into EAX, and we move that value onto the stack with a different offset, or no offset. So by moving the values directly onto the stack, we have achieved the same as these two push instructions, and we can call the adder function that will use the two values on top of the stack to do the sum. And then we know that the result returns in the EAX register. So here we take the result and we move it straight onto the stack again. And then we take the string and we move it directly onto the stack, overriding what's there. But so now we have the same result that we had with the push over here. We have a string and we have a value on top of the stack, and we call the print function that will then print the string and the number. So be aware, even though I have talked a lot about this use push, there are other ways. If you come across this, your job is to recognize this as, hey, this is the same. They're making the arguments available on the stack, then they're calling the function and they clean up. So prologue, call the function, epilogue. Same thing, just they use different instructions. Switch, moving on, switch statements make a decision based on characters or integers. This is very useful if you're implementing, well, you guys are not going to implement, but if the malware writers are implementing backdoors, where you can then select an action based on a single byte value. And so this is important. It's important to be able to recognize switch statements. And there are two common compile versions of this. You can use an if style or a jump table, and we'll go to both. So it's a switch statement. Based on the variable I, you either go to case 1, case 2, or case 3, and then you're done. So what does it look like if we use the if style in assembly? You use the compare. And now we've skipped a little bit here, but looks like the I variable is in on the stack 8 bytes down. So is I equal 1? Compare I to 1. If it is, then you jump to 401027. Where's that? Right here. And then you do this. We don't have to go through this, but you do this if I equals 1. Well, if it wasn't 1, then it continues. And then it compares I to 2. And then jump if it's 2. And if it's 2, it jumps down here. And then it's doing this stuff. And so forth. And then at the end here, if I is something else than 1, 2, or 3, we need a failsafe. We need a way out of this. So then we have a jump, unconditional jump, that takes us to 67, which is out below here. Actually, when I see my slide, it's even below here, because this is what you do if I equals 3. Not that complicated. If you just break it down, you have a bunch of comparisons up here. The test, is it 1, is it 2, is it 3, or is it something else? And you have sections of code that are executed when you get a match. And what's interesting for you as an analyst is to recognize that this is a switch statement and find out what is it doing. It could be that if I equals 1, then executes this code, connect to internet. If I equals 2, then fetch file. 3, upload file. That's the way they can use this. If you look at IDA Pro, this is the same code that we just saw presented by IDA Pro. Bit messy, but it's not a problem to walk through this too. We have a compare up here, you have a false and true, and in IDA this will be green and red, or red and green. And then it goes through here. If it's false here, then you check for 2. You have 2 options. It checks for 3, 2 options, and so forth. So you get through this in the same way, but not as it doesn't give a really nice picture here, but it's possible. So that was the if style. The problem with if style, and you might have seen it already, if you have many cases, so 1 to 3 is the first thing, but let's say you have 10, you get a lot of comparisons that you have to do. And it's not very efficient. That's when you use the jump table instead. And this, in the example in the book, they said, okay, 3 for the other example. Here we have 4. Then we use jump tables. I'm not sure whether the compiler makes the difference between 3 and 4, if it's up to you. But anyway, that's what we're going to look at here. So in this case, four different cases. Again, the value I decides what case is being executed. And this is what the assembly code looks like. First, on the top, subtract one. And just by looking at that, we there should have been something before, but you see now that ECX holds the variable I. And we subtract one. That just means we want to work on I minus one instead of I, not unheard of. That's quite common, actually, if you want to count from 0 to 3 instead of from 1 to 4. Then you put the ECX into onto the stack. You compare it to the value 3. And then you jump if above. That just means that if I is greater than 3 or I minus 1 is greater than 3, that means I is greater than 4, then you jump out of the program. It's in the legal range. Then you move your I minus 1, I'm sorry, into EDX. And then you jump to an address. 401.088. But then you have something in the bracket here, EDX times 4. EDX is I minus 1, so I minus 1 times 4. So if I minus 1 is 0, then you jump to this address. Now let's see where that is. See if I can find it. Here. And I've written here, jump address. If I equals 1, that means I minus 1 equals 0. Then you end up at this address, and you read a new address, location 401.02c. 401.02c will be here. Then you execute whatever is in here, and you get to an unconditional jump that takes you out of the program, I think. Or it takes you down here. You clean up EAX, restore the stack and return. So this is the epilogue. So that was I equals 1. If I equals 2, that means that we get I minus minus 1 equals 1. So then it's this address plus 4 bytes. And plus 4 bytes will be here. And then we get a different offset, 401.042 here. I equals 2, do this, and so forth. So this line jumps to this address plus an offset that depends on I. And that implementation is more efficient than the if style when the number of cases are larger. Okay. Or am I losing you guys? Here, IdaPro helps. It looks much nicer. The jump table looks much nicer in IdaPro. Because then you see a big, big block of code, and you have a red or a blue, red and green. If it's green, then you move towards the end, you're done. That means I is outside your range. If I is inside your range, you move down here, you get to that jump instruction that is offset by dependent on I, and then you see these nice boxes lined up. Sometimes IdaPro would draw them next to each other like this, but it's quite easy to see that you get down to one place here, and then there are multiple choices, but you only go to one of them, and then you continue. Switch statement, jump table style. And then your job, of course, is to figure out what parameter decides what case we choose and what happens. In malware, it's very common that malware collects the commands that they want to execute in this style. So I equals 1, execute command number 1. I equals 2, execute command number 2. And then it's your job to find out what are these commands. All right? arrays. Ordered set of similar data items could be used as an array of pointers to strings of multiple host names. If they want to connect out to different hosts, they can have an array of pointers to different host names. One array, B, with five entries. Notice that this is outside the main program, so this is then a global array. And there's one here, A of five, is a local. And in the same way that we have, there's a difference between global and local variables, there's also a difference between global and local arrays. In all the examples up until now, we've only seen local variables where we address the stack with a certain offset. So, let's see. Okay, so what we're going to look for now is the initialization of a variable I. We have two arrays, A and B, and there's a for loop that counts I from 0 to 4, and then it sets A and B equal I. See if we can figure that one out here. Top line, I is moved, I equals 0, so the value of 0 is moved into a local variable put on the stack, displaced 18 bytes. And then line number 2, unconditional jump to a different memory address down here. Why it's doing this, that's optimization, compiler settings. I guess it makes sense for in the assembly world. Jump down there. Then you compare your I to 5. And if it's greater or equal to 5, then you jump somewhere. And that will be 41037. So that's outside the program. This is when we're done. I is greater or equal than 5. We're done. Before we're done, we have to do this. We take I, move into ECX. We take I, move into EDX. Probably going to use them for something. And here it is. First, we take EDX, so I. And we're moving it into EDP, so base pointer, plus ECX, which is I. So I times 4 bytes. So that looks like a displacement up or down or on the stack, and then variable 14 a variable displaced 14 bytes. So depending on, so this is then A of I equals I, so we put the value I into A of I, and the location of A of I is on the stack displaced by ECX. And we see that this is A because this is a local variable. We see that on the style here. What we expect when there's a local variable. And if you look here, remember, A is defined inside, so that's local. B is defined outside, global. Then we move I again into EAX and ECX. And then we see D word and something like, and an address. This is the style we expect when it's a global variable. We also see a displacement depending on I that we find in ECX, and we move the value EAX into that location. So this is BI equals I, but it's a global variable, so it's put into memory. But again, displaced by ECX. And then we jump back up somewhere, I assume, there. Increment I, continue. until this compare tells us that I is too big. So to summarize, base address for A of I is EBP plus the var 14, and the displacement from the base address is 4 bytes times whatever value I has. For B of I, global variable, the base address is 40A300, and from there we displace with ECX times 4, so I times 4. Question? Yes, the question was if I equals 1, you would think you get EBP plus, and then you have var 14, you move 4 bytes and you get to 18, and that's where I is located. Good question, and with the first glance, I'll tend to agree with you. So then we'll either we didn't understand something, or the book is been a little quick with the example. But I think your first impression is that your concern looks right. Okay. So I don't have a better answer than that. If somebody understand something else with this example than what was brought up now, then please let us know. But I think it looks like you're right. But even with that, the key thing here is the principle, that you understand the principle. That you have a base address that looks different whether it's a local or a global variable, and that you use the register ECX to decide the displacement away from the base address, and that displacement is then a function of I, which is also your index in your array. Moving on. Structures or structs, very similar to arrays, but the elements can be of different types. And this is used to group information easier to maintain than individual variables. The Windows API functions frequently use this. They are also accessed with a base address as a starting pointer, like we saw with the other arrays. It can be a little bit more difficult to interpret what information is included in the structs. Are they just next to each other, or are they part of the same struct? It might not always be so clear. But your ability to identify structs will help you, greatly help you in the analysis. And IDAPRO offers a tool with a hotkey T, you find in the menu too, where you can define structs and assign them to memory references, such that your analysis, so if you have discovered a struct in the malware and you understood how it's built up, you can define this in IDAPRO, and then it's much easier to understand the rest of the code. It's almost like labeling a variable and giving them names that you want. See if we can get through an example here too. And as I warned you about earlier, it gets more and more complicated as we get further out in the book. All right. So we define a struct that has an array X with 5 entries. We have a character Y, and we have a double Z is what we're looking at. Let's see if we can break down the assembly here. If you, whenever you see push EBP, move EBP, ESP, you should think prologue. This was a function call. We were saving, we're saving EBP for later. We were updating the EBP with the value of the ESP. Okay, first thing we do is we push 20 hex, and again, decimal 32, if you're more comfortable there, 32 bytes. So we push 32 onto the stack, and we call a function called malloc. If you've never seen it before, you need to look it up. But this allocates 32 bytes of memory. And then we're guessing that this struct that we're looking at requires 32 bytes. That makes sense. Then add ESP4, cleaning up the stack again. Then what we get back here that we don't see, but when you call a function, I've said it many times now, then you get a result back in EAX. And here we get something in EAX that we move into a D word with a name 40EA30. So when we ask malloc to allocate 32 bytes, we also get back a base address in memory. Where did you allocate this? Return in EAX, we put it into this variable name here. And you see by the style, this is a global variable. Then we're going to use it, so we push it into EAX, we move it into EAX, we push EAX on the stack, and we call a function that for right now is just called 401 401000. We'll get to that, but that is called with the base address as an input. And then when we return from that call, this is just epilogue. We clean up the stack, reset the EAX, pop the base pointer, and return. So we allocated 32 bytes, and we use that to call. We use the base address return to call a function. And if you saw, the call went to 401000. And at that address, we find this. Following addresses around like this is a lot of your job in IDA Pro. you start analyzing somewhere, and you're being guided towards a different area based on what addresses you have to follow. Okay. First part, push EBP, move EBP, ESP, prologue. Then we put ECX on the stack. Not clear to me what that is right now, but again, look at the big picture. Don't understand every single line. That's a great line for me, by the way, so I don't have to explain everything I don't understand. But the first one here, EBP arg 0 into EAX. That is the base address of the structure. And I didn't show you that. I made this nice figure. When you reserve the 32-bit, we can assume, this is my assumption, but you can assume that that fits 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 entries on the array, if a character and a double. So it makes sense. So here you have the base address. You can also read from this that 61 hex is the, if I remember correctly, the character A, and that goes into EAX plus 14. So 14 hex 14 means 4, 8, 12, 16, 20, 24, what is it, 20? Anyway, if you do it the decimal, it should align nicely up with this position, multiple of 4 bytes down. So there's a character, and I think it's the letter A. You can check this. The program says, at least, that we should put the letter A into the character Y. So then I'm assuming that 61 hex is it's in 97. It should be, if this example makes, it should make sense, then it should be. So yeah. So well, that's homework. It the principle works. There is something put into this position, and it should be a character. Then you should also see here that there's an operation here on a quad word. So this has something to do with a double, and you see that is offset to 18. So that's here. So then you can assume that these two lower positions are for the double. Then it's possible to recognize a for loop in here. Remember, we're going to fill the array. If you go back, so an A into the character Y, there's 15.6 into the quad, and then there's a for loop that puts I into the X of Y position. So by now you should be able to read this and see that here's a loop. There's a conditional jump here. There's a comparison right before where you compare the value 5 to whatever you have in the local variable on the stack. And that local variable up here is moving into EDX, and it's incremented and written back. So this looks like an increment. Here you compare it to 5, and you end it if it's greater than or equal to 5. And if not, you perform this, and you jump here back up there. So maybe I should have done loop down there. But this is a loop. And then there should be somewhere in there, there should be a reference to an address with a displacement that's dependent on I. And just from what we looked at so far here, when you see this EAX times 4, then I'm guessing that I is put into EAX. And if you go back, then we see that yes, EBP var 4 is put into EAX. And EBP var 4, that's the one we use for comparison, and it's also the one that we increment. So it makes sense. And then when we're done, we clean up. No questions online? You guys asleep, or is it crystal clear? Assuming the last. A little bit more details and things to keep track of. But it is, if you try to break it down, remember, you don't have this when you see the memo. This is gone. So you get this, and you need to recognize that, hey, they allocate some bytes. They get a base point address back. Well, how do they use that? What do they put into this struct? And then you go and say, okay, there's a loop here. We have references to certain addresses. So then you can get to this figure eventually. I think this is the last one, and the one that is, you see, yeah. Linked lists. This is a data structure. It's a sequence of data records. And each record that you put in there has a link to the next record. That means that you can have an order of items stored in memory that is linked together by information in the record, so they don't have to be sequential in memory. And the advantage with that is that you can then insert and remove items on the list without having to alter the whole memory. A written example, see the book. This is probably dead honest with you and say that this is I find difficult to follow myself. but I'll give you a couple of hints from what I was able to get out of this, and then just leave it up to, if you come across something that looks like this, then think linked list, and then spend the effort then to dig deeper. The point there, if you look at the C code first, it's there's a loop here, and there's a loop here. So there's something we're creating 10 nodes, and we're filling them with data. There's a malloc used here, and then also a while loop here, where you iterate over all records and you print whatever's in them. So let's see if we can at least can recognize these constructs. There are two variables up here, local, that we can see that we use. One is the head and one is I. And head is one of the variables that you could find somewhere in here. Head equals zero. At least we can recognize the loop here. If you go through this, a loop, then you look for a conditional jump. And where is it? It's right here. You compare I, this value, with decimal 10. That makes sense. We were supposed to go in a loop for 10 rounds. And then you jump if it's outside. If not, you perform this. And you see here, there's a call to malloc. So you allocate room in the memory for each iteration, and you get back a base point address. I'm not going to go through that. I'm not going to even attempt. But there's a lot of moving around of the data. If you are familiar with what the C code is doing, it should be able to now compare what's inside that that loop there, and what's there. And that's the whole point here. Find a big picture, and if you have to go in deeper. And then the while loop is also fairly easy to find, because there's a compare, and you compare it to the other variable that you defined in the beginning, and you compare it to zero. So here you do something until this variable is zero, and then you jump out if it reaches that value. If not, then you do this, and we see that we take variables from the stack. We move things into positions on the stack, and we call printf. And what we can see here is that they use the move notation and not the push. So just realize that here's a value pushed, and here's a string pushed, and then we call and we print both. And a lot of details that we didn't cover here, but this is also a good example of what you're going to meet. Identify the big picture first, the while and the for loop. Identify the variables that are important in the conditional jump. So the EBP var 4, trace that back and see what it is, and then find out what's important here. This is a call. This is a call for print, so this prints something. But if there was a call to a function that you didn't know what was in here, then you need to say, okay, it goes through a while loop and it calls a special function every time. What is that function doing? And that's your next job. Not necessarily understanding every single line in here, but what you need to do is, if that function is called, in order to understand what it's doing, you might have to understand what are the values that are pushed in the stacks and that are given as input. It's great in IDA Pro is that if you highlight one variable, it will highlight every instance of it. So you will see every other place where it's used. Okay, 9:59. Any last-minute question? Because that was the last slide of today's lecture. No online, no from the class. What we will do then is end the lecture and labs. Sergei has put out or written a short tutorial on IDA. So what you need to do in this lab, these 2 lab hours, and after the class, if you need to catch up, you need to be familiar with IDA Pro. And I think the best way is to start working on Chapter 6. Do the lab there. And if you then don't know how to use IDA Pro, go back and figure it out. Use the tutorial or ask. But the main thing is now there is a lab for Chapter 6 where you will get practice in identifying the structures that we talked about. So your objective now is get comfortable with IDA and be able to recognize C constructs in assembly. If you have time and you find the labs in the book boring, then get a wild sample somewhere and try it out. It might be frustratingly difficult, or it might be interesting. You never know. But there is no way, if you're going to master this skill, there is no way other than get your hands dirty on unknown samples. Final thing I want to say before we take a break and continue with lab is that I want to repeat that next Monday is a visit from NOSOT, a highly skilled analyst coming up, talking about a case where you're going to need all the skills that I've been trying to teach you, and then some. You'll probably get some teasers on what you also need to learn in the next week. And also you'll get your first assignment, a sample that you need to analyze using everything, or at least hopefully everything, but a lot of what you learned up until now. So basic static analysis, basic dynamic analysis, and advanced static by looking into the assembly code. Write that up in a report, and then I'll have to judge it and see if you're allowed to continue. We'll talk about the criteria later, but yeah. All right. There was a question. I'll do that. Let's see. There's a question about the dates on the first assignment. I'll have to look to see if that's if it's correct. Looks like it's wrong dates. I'll fix it. At least look at it. All right. Then I spent 5 minutes of your break, so we'll start 10:20. See you next week.